Receiving this transmission, you are the resistance. InfoWars, the most banned network in the world.
One of the
Good afternoon. I understand there's no break today and would appreciate getting a heads up from anybody in the chat room right now. If so, I will begin my show. Hello out there. Can anyone hear me? Okay. I understand we had a little glitch this afternoon, and so welcome to Eagle Flower, Conversations with Eagle Flower. And in case you feel like you need a little bit of a break, tune in, join in, and spend the next hour here. You never know what comes up, do you? Well, this is the first day of May. What a way to start, huh? We're in a half moon on May Day. What more could we ask for? And our weather continues to fluctuate. Last night we registered 33 degrees overnight. And the same is coming up for Friday night. And we're in and out of rainy spells right now that are nicely taking away our winter drought. And so far, it looks like we're getting some nice half inch of rain about every 3 or 4 days. So we really need it here, and frankly, I'm glad to see it. I'm not sure how the farmers are doing out in the fields because it might be too wet. So anyhow, enough for our weather. We hope, by the way, some of the leaves on the trees are just starting to bud out, and so we are getting a nice hazy look of pretty soon we're going to have some green trees and bushes. So welcome again to listeners of Revolution Radio. And I hope you're having a good day today. Again, take a chair and sit back and relax. I am not going to be doing the fear porn today. Although it butts right up against it in many different ways, and see if you can figure it out. As always, I like to thank everybody for coming here to listen and to support Revolution Radio, and we appreciate it. My Eagle Flower saying is, let's learn together and build our best future with clarity, strength, and wisdom. And I just remembered something here that I didn't do yet. Let me see if I can figure out how I'm going to get back in there to do it. Okay. Got it. All right. Here we go. Now I got totally distracted. Today's theme is Memories and More, a day of moons, M&Ms, and May Day, too. I'll begin with a quote by Lucy Larcom. When April steps aside for May, like diamonds all the raindrops glisten. Fresh violets open every day. To some new bird each hour we listen. Yeah, yes, May Day. And through the years, we've heard so much about May Day. And actually, we're just glad that it's turned the calendar into May. Most of us are. And I'm at the beginning here, I'm going to read some little tidbits about some of the history. I think a whole hour could be spent very easily on the long, long history of how we got to what we call May Day. And this abstract is from AtlasObscura.com. The ancient roots of Beltane are more mundane. It had a lot to do with cows, and it wasn't on May 1st. It did, however, mark the most important transition of the year. Travel back about 6,000 years to the time when hunter-gatherers across northern Europe were starting to settle down. Agriculture spreading north and west across the continent had arrived. People living in what's now Ireland and the United Kingdom were starting to sow crops and raise livestock. And with this lifestyle shift came a new focus on charting the seasons to regulate farming and herding activities. Over millennia, early agrarians around the world, from China to Mesopotamia, developed regional agricultural calendars based on the movement of the heavens, most commonly the sun and the moon, and the ancient people living in the British Isles were no different. And I'll proceed on to an article that comes from AmericanHistory.edu. The roots of May Day go all the way back to ancient world. And this article, they're going back to the Roman days. For the Romans, the 1st of May stood at the heart of the Floralia, a week-long festival to honor Flora, goddess of youth, spring, and flowers. When the Romans reached the British Isles, their Floralia festival collided with the Celtic holiday of Beltane, also held around the 1st of May. Elements of both celebrations combined to lay the foundations for what became known as May Day, which by the medieval period had become a cherished holiday throughout Europe. Every year, villagers would go a-maying, venturing out in the early morning to collect flowers and decorate their town for the day's festivities. During the day, villages would hold a number of games, pageants, and dances, and many would crown a young woman May Queen to preside over the fun. At the heart of the festivities stood the Maypole, pulled into town by a pair of flower-adorned oxen. The pole, which was usually a cut birch tree, was raised and decorated with colorful streamers that villagers could hold as they danced. And that's the end that I wanted to quote from that article. And as you can tell, just from what I've read so far, because everybody was more in the agrarian lifestyle in years past or in times past, it all revolved around the change of the season. And I'm going to read a little bit from it's almanac.com, The Origins of May Day. And this one begins by saying, did you know that May Day has its roots in astronomy? Traditionally, it was the halfway point between the spring equinox and the summer solstice. In ancient times, this is one of the Celtic cross-quarter days, which marked the midway points between the four solstices and equinoxes of the year. As with many early holidays, May Day was rooted in agriculture. Springtime festivities filled with song and dance celebrated the sown fields starting to sprout. Cattle were driven to pasture. Special bonfires were lit, and the doors of houses and livestock were decorated with yellow mayflowers. In the Middle Ages, the Gaelic people celebrated the festival of Beltane, which means Day of Fire. People created large bonfires and danced at night to celebrate. And that's what I wanted to read from that particular article. And what I find interesting, which they didn't really elicit very well in here, the change of pasturing is how the cattle got involved in all of this, because of the change of season, the higher elevation pastures would then be where the cattle and the sheep and whatever else were grazers would be moved accordingly. And that's why May Day became popular. And isn't it interesting? We've been going in all of these festivities now, I think, since the end of February, through March, into April, through April, and we're in May Day, and these old celebrations went from one to the other to the other. I was thinking about that today. And that's the end of my May Day discourse. Cesare Pavese has a quote by saying, "We do not remember days, we remember moments." And this is followed up by a quote from Jeremy Irons. "We all have our time machines. Some take us back. They're called memories. Some take us forward. They're called dreams." Memories. Where do they store? Are they hidden away or at our front door? Are stories filled with certain memories all dressed up as lore? Do memories store in places? Do wind and water hold memory and move it around? And Bob Dylan has this quote, "If you want to keep your memories, you first have to live them." What prompts our fond memories or holds them? This next story is so simply colors a holder of family memories. And it's called The Table, written by Nick Wojcik. It's a Readsy.com entry. And he begins, "Bryce drove along the North Shore, lost in thought, which was easy to do for most people given the surrounding beauty of the drive. Anyone expecting white sands and turquoise blue waters to match their Google image searches would be disappointed. But this was the real North Shore to Bryce, the steel blue waters of Lake Superior, the jagged cliffs carved out to make room for the Voyager Road and the endless expanse of pine trees, giving much-needed air to a brain deep in thought. And Bryce pulled over at a scenic viewpoint just north of Two Harbors to stare out into the presumed lake that may as well be an ocean. He had a problem. He had a solution to that problem. And that solution caused further problems. He needed to think on how to solve those problems. Bryce worked at a state park about an hour outside of Duluth. He was happy with his job, happy with where his family lived, and happy with his family, mostly. His current initial problem, for which he had to solve, was that his two young boys, ages 4 and 2, were already too enamored with screens, tablets, toasters, or really anything that ran on electricity, in his opinion. As a state park representative and someone who survived 30 years of Minnesota winters to still come out in the positive opinion side of the area, he felt like he was losing a battle with his boys. And the solve he had was to build a kitchen table for their home. Some of his fondest memories with his parents were playing board games and sharing ice cream at their kitchen table. His wife and himself moved into a home just before his first son was born, and in the inevitable shuffle and never-ending war with unpacking, they just never got around to filling that space in their kitchen. The result were dinners on the couch with the TV shouting in the background. Having a place to sit as a family for dinner and play games was a necessity. For some reason, the world, nor Bryce will ever know, he felt the need to build the table himself. But Bryce was not a carpenter. He had not won his Boy Scouts Pine Wood Derby. nor did he have an expansive wealth of tools to complete the task. Oh, and of course there was the problem of all the white pine that was in his truck bed, currently waiting to surprise his unknowing wife. Undeterred and having come up with absolutely no real game plan, Bryce returned to his truck and drove the remaining miles home. His wife Phoebe was in the front yard tossing a ball to their 2-year-old son Travis, and their older son Ryan sat on the porch with Phoebe's phone in his hands, playing some kind of game. As Phoebe's eyes landed on Bryce's gray Ford F-150, her smile slowly faded to an exhausted stare as the large planks of wood grew in her field of vision. Phoebe spoke more exasperated than angry. "Bryce, I don't know what half-baked plan you have now, but I cannot take another project. Your beer brewing kit, the smoker, and that rust bucket already take up half of our garage." Bryce put on his best innocent face to mix with his defense. "First and foremost, a Chevy Nova is not a rust bucket, no matter how little of an engine it has. Secondly, I think you'll appreciate the direction of this new and fully baked plan." Bryce gave a nod to his oldest son playing the games on her phone. It wasn't like their children only played electronic games, but even Phoebe was beginning to get concerned with their enjoying screen time a little bit too much. He could tell she was intrigued, so he had made it past the first hurdle and went on to explain his idea of building a kitchen table. And she was hooked like a Minnesotan to a table of hot dish. The next 3 weeks might as well have been a journey through the stages of grief. There was denial, both on Phoebe and Bryce's part, on whether the project would come to fruition. There was anger, mostly on Bryce's part, on why the hell these pieces of wood wouldn't cooperate with him. Bargaining, again, talking to the wood, trying to convince it to do things. Depression. Finally, acceptance that the table would forever be called rustic, but nonetheless a completed farmhouse-style table with 5 planks across the top with a natural finish coat. The thing was laid out. Bryce stayed home and got some help moving the completed table into the kitchen while the kids were at the daycare. Visions in his head of the kids running home with great excitement were springing to life. However, the initial night of the table's existence did not go necessarily as planned. They sat down for dinner and the kids barely ate anything before wanting to get up and play or go watch cartoons. Bryce and Phoebe finished talking about their day, though, with a great feeling of connection, so all was not lost. The next day, they decided to do family game night. They pulled Candyland and some bags of popcorn, and the kids yelled with excitement. The table took its first battle scar that evening, as Travis had some wax weapons holstered in his pockets. He drew out the colorful pistols and proceeded to draw lines on the uncoated legs of the table while the rest of the family finished up their game. When Phoebe saw him and grabbed the crayons from his hand, she thought Bryce might be upset given the work he put into the table. But he just smiled and said to Travis, "Thanks, buddy. The table was missing some character." From that moment on, the table became the focal point of the family's evenings. They did story time, with 3 of them sitting around one side as the others would share. They did art projects that were varying degrees of fridge worthiness. Phoebe and Bryce budgeted their bills after the kids went to sleep. The crayons weren't the only damages taken either. Milk, toys, keys, food, glass being unceremoniously dropped at one point or another. They fought, they played, and bit by bit, the table soaked up the life around it. the grains of wood becoming veins, bringing energy to each board and leg. The weeks turned into years, and the table felt all the ups and downs that the family experienced. The table was there to support Ryan's head when he came home crying after his first day of elementary school because he didn't think he would make any new friends. The table held up all the goodies proudly for the celebration of Bryce's father's beating cancer. The table remained when the couch was removed, when the fridge was changed out, and the kitchen floor remodeled. Each year that passed, the table could feel what the family felt more and more, because Bryce, Phoebe, and the boys put their lives out to it. Years turned into more years, and the boys had left the house to start their own lives. Bryce and Phoebe decided to move near a lodge near the Boundary Waters to live out their golden years. Moving boxes were stacked on the table as it felt the gravity of moving from the home. Bryce shifted a box and some office supplies scattered to the floor. As he knelt down to pick them up, he looked over at the table leg and smiled. The wax had faded over the years, but Travis's crayon markings remained tattooed upon the table. And in that moment, the table was able to share all the memories it kept within. Tears started collecting in Bryce's eyes as he reached out to touch the table. It was a totem for all that their family was. He stood there for a moment, allowing the warmth and calmness of the table's memories to pass over him, and knew that the table would be there for him again. Very touching story, wasn't that? And it reminds me also that we very often, especially people who are a little bit more sensitive, can pick up things and feel different. They call it, you know, getting a vibe off of something. And basically that's how it happens, is we put our memories into our clothing and our surroundings without realizing it. A quote by Robert Brault. Enjoy the little things, for one day you may look back and realize they were the big things. Next is a very short story called Kisses, and it's a very touching one. And this is from VarietyReading.com. The story goes that some time ago a man punished his 3-year-old daughter for wasting a roll of gold wrapping paper. Money was tight, and he became infuriated when the child tried to decorate a box to put under the Christmas tree. Nevertheless, the little girl brought the gift to her father the next morning and said, "This is for you, Daddy." And he was embarrassed by his earlier overreaction, but his anger flared again when he found the box was empty. And he yelled at her, "Don't you know when you give someone a present, there's supposed to be something inside it?" The little girl looked up at him with tears in her eyes and said, "Oh, Daddy, it's not empty. I blew kisses into the box, all for you, Daddy." The father was crushed. He put his arms around his little girl and begged for her forgiveness. A short time later, an accident took the life of his child. And it is said that the man kept that gold box by his bed for many years. Whenever he was discouraged, he would take out an imaginary kiss and remember the love of the child who had put it there. That's quite a story, isn't it? Okay, taking this memory idea onto another trajectory, and this kind of goes into the folklore things and how traditions get started. It's a poem, and it's called The Calf Path. that was originally written by Sam Walter Foss, published in 1895. One day through the primeval wood, a calf walked home, as good calves should, but made a trail all bent askew, a crooked trail, as all calves do. Since then, 300 years have fled, and I infer the calf is dead. But still he left behind his trail, and thereby hangs my moral tale. The trail was taken up next day by a lone dog that passed that way, and then a wise bellwether sheep pursued the trail o'er hill and glade. Through those old woods a path was made, and many men wound in and out, and dodged and turned and bent about, and uttered words of righteous wrath, because 'twas such a crooked path. But still they followed, do not laugh, the first migrations of that calf. And through this winding woodway stalked, because he wobbled when he walked. This forest path became a lane that bent and turned again. This crooked lane became a road where many a horse with his load toiled on beneath the burning sun and traveled some 3 miles in one. And thus a century and a half they trod the footsteps of that calf. The years passed on in swiftness fleet, the road became a village street, and thus, before men were aware, a city's crowded thoroughfare, and soon the central street was this of a renowned metropolis, and men 2 centuries and a half trod in the footsteps of that calf. Each day 100,000 rout followed this zigzag calf about, and o'er his crooked journey went the traffic of a continent. 100,000 men were led by one calf, near 3 centuries dead. They followed still his crooked way, and lost 100 years a day. For thus such reverence is lent to well-established precedent. For men are prone to go it blind, along the calf paths of the mind, and work away from sun to sun to do what other men have done. They follow in the beaten track, and out and in and forth and back, and still their devious course pursue, to keep the path that others do. They keep the path a sacred groove along which all their lives they move. But how the wise old wood gods laugh who saw that first primeval calf. Many things this tale may preach, but I am not ordained to teach. And my contribution to the end of this. And so, on our personal paths, do we look around and seek a clearer meaning to our tracks that maybe need a tweak? Oh, yes. I have often wondered how we get to where we are, and yet we shouldn't wonder at all. And I was just glancing here over in the chat room, and thanks, everybody, for tuning in. And hi, Mitzi, and Pat Rabbit, and see, Jim Jones is in there, too, and whoever else is there. Thank you. Taking this memory on idea on yet another trajectory. Unusual abilities, or is it simply uncovering them? Another memory from another age? This coming story called Water into Wine by Sophie Irish. Her main character, Lucy, is blind and tells her story. Okay, Water into Wine. I should say from the beginning that Lucy is a blind young girl as we begin the story. Wandering through the hospital halls, running my fingers along the walls. The silence was calming and familiar. It was late, and I was waiting for my mother to finish her rounds. It was boring, so I roamed, as I often did. I could hear the rhythmic beeping of machines and the shuffles of patients, followed by the scurry of doctors and nurses. Every evening, the same, a slight heaviness in the air and murmurs from loved ones. My mom worked on the ICU ward, so the atmosphere was either chaotic and loud or layered with a strange and ominous serenity. I tried to imagine what it would look like, the stories from my mother on replay in my head, the bright lights and boring colors that lined the walls and floors, rooms with wires and leads that were literally a lifeline to those suffering here. But it's hard to imagine seeing when you never, in fact, have been able to do so. I was very acclimated by now, as I'd hit my teens, but I often daydreamed in my own special way and created my own image of sorts. I don't know what you would call them or how I would even describe them to seeing people, but that made it even more distinct to me. I was in my own world, and if I didn't like things I'd hear, I'd change what I see in my mind's eye. In the distance, I could hear rushed footsteps that I knew to be my mother's. A little huff and puff of annoyance in her breath, I rolled my eyes. "Lucy, what did I tell you about going off on your own and without your stick?" She sighed, exasperated, and grabbed my hand to whisk me around. "There are very sick people here, Lucy. They don't need to be bothered." "Well, what else am I supposed to do? You drag me here every day while you work." I never wanted to make her feel guilty. I understood she was a single mom providing for me and doing an admirable job, but I also felt like I was missing out on a childhood, which already came with its challenges. As she dragged me along, the silence grew louder and crushed its way inward in my head, and I jolted awake. My head rested on my forearms. I dreamt of my childhood often. Now I was 33 and working in the same hospital my mom did, though she opted for an early retirement when the sudden death of a relative provided her with the means to do so. I quite liked working here, although thanks to my disability, I'm limited on the jobs that they'll let me do. I'm the kind of employee that did a little bit here and a little bit there. I would probably only be allowed as a volunteer if it weren't for Mom pulling some strings, which did wonders for my self-esteem. I spent a lot of time in the chapel here in the evenings after my administrative duties and found comfort in comforting people. As I lifted my head off the desk, where I had apparently decided to snooze, and peeled pieces of paper off my face. The little indentations allowed me to read now were indented on my face. It was quiet, and I could tell that I was alone. And being blind, you develop a sixth sense of just knowing if there were people around you or not, no matter how stealthy they try to be. I learned this the hard way in school. In the background, the water cooler gurgled and the coffee machine hummed. Peace and quiet was suddenly disturbed by the staff room door crashing open and banging into the wall behind it. "Still here?" Angela said, her voice always a few octaves too high for my liking. Yes, yes, still here, I yawned. Well, go home. Your shift ended an hour ago. And she was always very bossy and frequently had to be reminded she wasn't my boss. But she was a close colleague and friend, so I gave her moment from time to time. She knew almost everything about me and my life. Often she tried to get me on the dating scene, but an ex-boyfriend who did more than betray me in every sense of the word ruined any hopes of a new love interest anytime soon. My flat was a short 10 minutes away, and I knew it well. I refused to have the stick and hadn't used it since I was young. Dangerous, maybe. Stupid, definitely. I strolled past the streetlight that flickered first, then held on to the railing that ran adjacent to the road, praying there'd be no gum or excess of germs today. When it came to an end, I turned, listened for any oncoming traffic, and crossed. Sharp left, walk 10 steps, sharp right, voila, I'm home. The trick is to walk like a seeing person to avoid any unwanted attention from potential muggers. I had to be vigilant, being a female in my state. When I got inside, I palmed my way to the kitchen, and then she went on to have a nice snack. My best friend and roommate, Katie, said I was too lazy to be a blind person. Apparently, I make my life more difficult than it needs to be, and I should have bumpy labels all over everything, not to mention a healthier lifestyle. I personally like the element of surprise and occasional danger. She worked nights, so the flat was silent and nag-free. Ding went her microwave, and so she unwrapped her dinner and had whatever surprise of the night it would be, and that night it was macaroni and cheese. After I went to my bedroom and found my easel, believe it or not, and as ironic as it is, drawing and painting was my outlet and hobby. It was incredibly challenging at first, and let's be honest, who knows what they turned out like, but who could argue? At the very least, I'd get the pity vote, although there were a few I showed Katie recently, and she said that there was something wrong with me and that I was some kind of prodigy for artists. Katie was convinced I had bought them or got someone else to do it for me, until one day I did one in front of her. But I still liked the idea that it could be a total crap, and I'd never know the difference. The weird thing is, the things I drew were images in my head that aren't like the shapes and colors I made up. To me, they seemed like the real thing, but I had nothing to compare it to. It was normally images of people, sick people, so 3D I could touch it. Every scar, wrinkle, and feature was enhanced. I would always draw them healthy and happy. Maybe it's because I grew up in a hospital surrounded by this kind of people that I can piece the visual puzzle together more easily and emotively based on things I'd heard and felt. Today it was an image of a child. Sadness filled her eyes that were swimming in tears. She was smaller than she should be. Light eyes, no hair. My heart lurched at her pain. I felt for my pencils, feeling the tips for the right size and density, and started to draw. Hours passed, and I drew until she was smiling and full of life, the pink back in her cheeks, her sunken eyes now bright. Shortly after, I climbed into bed and thought about her as I drifted off. When I got to the hospital for my next shift, there was commotion in the reception area. "It's a miracle," Angela said, snapping her gums loudly. I shivered, and not a sound in the world I hated more. "What's going on?" I asked. Little Sally on third floor, terminal cancer. Woke up today, no cancer. I could hear the disbelief and excitement in her voice in between the chomping of, it's a miracle. You sure she wasn't misdiagnosed? No, she had it most of her little life, several rounds of chemo. Parents are over the moon. I don't think they're atheists now. She laughed, a bit exaggerated. That's great, I said, and left to go to the staff room for some coffee. Something about this story was niggling at me, though, and not just because it sounded too good to be true. But I couldn't pinpoint why. I didn't recognize the name, but the image of my drawing kept popping up in my mind. And there's no way, I told myself, fighting the inner irrational child that was screaming at me that I healed her. I laughed the thought away and got back to my shift. Later, Angela invited herself over to my place for some wine, and we chatted for a while, laughing and basically drinking ourselves under the table. So she helped me to the bedroom to find some clean clothes or pajamas that she had somewhere in there. And Angela said, Lucy, these drawings are stunning. Where did you get them? Well, I drew them, I said, waiting for the usual doubt. Babe, you're in the wrong job. Stupid question, really. There's an easel right next to him, she cackled. I could hear her sifting through them. No way, she whispered, which was odd. What is it? I thought you said you didn't know little Sally. Even though realistically, if you did, you wouldn't know what she looked like anyway. I don't know who she is. You've drawn her, she shrieked, just sifting through more aggressively. Oh, my God. And I heard her slump on my bed. This was a woman who got discharged a couple of weeks ago. Coma due to postpartum difficulties during surgery. And this one. Lucy, you painted these people healthy and now they are. You're blind. This can't be a coincidence. I honestly didn't know what to say. I'd been having the thoughts myself, but we're talking about something that isn't possible. Draw another one right now, she demanded. Angie, they take hours. I don't care. We have to see if this is real. She walked me over to my easel. I closed my eyes, took a few deep breaths, until an image popped up, but it was an older gentleman this time, wheelchair-bound. I drew him standing and smiling. Now we wait, Angela said. She ended up crashing on the couch, and we both walked to work with sore heads the following morning. When we arrived, there was commotion again at the reception desk. He just walked right out of here, an unknown voice beamed. Sounded young, pretty. Angela pushed past me. I headed to the staff room. After a few moments of peace, the door slammed open. Angie, can you please be more careful with that door? My head is pounding. Lucy, you did it. This is incredible. What a gift. She physically picked me up and spun me around. It's not possible. There must be some reasonable explanation, I stuttered, my ears hot and adrenaline tickling my body. Huh, yeah, there is. You're like the new upgraded Jesus, she laughed. I chuckled at the thought and the delivery. We sat talking about it for a while, but I left early. My head was spinning. Maybe from the wine and maybe from the miracle. I went straight to my room, picked up my pencils, and started drawing with desperate determination. This was difficult. The image I had of myself were descriptions from my family and relatives, but I had to try. If I really did heal these people, did I have the ability to make myself see. Well, is that a story or what? Here's a very short poem called A Journey Sublime by Kurt Philip Baim. Feeling beyond touch, the sorcerer said, knowledge beyond thought, all memory ahead. Faith beyond healing, its mercy divine, love beyond giving, a journey sublime. Not sure if I have time to read this whole next article, but we'll have fun with it because it is a story on how, what kind of perspective, how we might value things, especially fond memories. And it does have a Christmas motif, but that's basically in the background. It's called The Lottery Ticket by Joanne Parsons from Readsy.com. And it begins, my husband and I agreed not to spend money on Christmas gifts. Neither of us needed for the sake of having piles of wrapped presents under the tree. He complied but couldn't resist filling my stocking with bags of M&Ms and holiday-themed lottery tickets. It was a thoughtful gesture and efficient at the same time. One Christmas Eve trip to CVS and his holiday shopping was done. I cursed him for buying the M&Ms, knowing I'd be plowing into the bag after dinner. And he ignored me and dug a dime out of his pocket and said, come on now, get scratching. The lottery ticket didn't yield any money, but I came out a big winner. I'm trying to grasp that I'm 75 years old and don't look much like myself anymore. I keep trying to exercise and watching my diet except for the M&Ms. And lately I've been in what I'm calling my reflective period, looking back at my life. I do count my blessings, but more often lament my mistakes, dwell on the times I was let down, regret my impulsivity, and wish I could take back words I said without thinking. I understand I could live another 20 years, and I don't intend to linger in this reflective mood for all of them. I'll just get it over with now and move on with living in the present, embracing my creaky bones and gray hair. This reflective period has given me a clear view of myself. Naive in my 20s, brash and impulsive in my 30s, an older me wants to guide and advise her, share the wisdom earned by her missteps. Instead, I find myself giving life advice to anyone who stands still long enough, my kids and grandkids, telling them to use their time thoughtfully because the decisions they make today will affect their tomorrows. It's all the stuff I wish I knew then, but of course they're busy being naive and brash and don't have time to listen. As I look in the rear view mirror at my life, I see now that my lowest points when I was feeling lost, defeated, and hopeless were opportunities to stand tall, be strong, smart, and wise. The times I was let down, hurt, or disappointed were the hours to shine, rise above the fray, and move forward. And I did. I had to. There was no one else. I struggled through, maybe whining and crying, surely bumbling and tripping. But I never fell. I had that. I never fell. The holiday-themed scratch tickets awaited. My husband leaned closer, sure his $10 investment would yield fortunes. I used the dime to expose the winning numbers and started scratching the ornaments on the tree, hoping for big money. Instead, when I revealed the first number, 41, it occurred to me that I married my late husband and began a new life when I was 41. I smiled, thinking of the day we married, my excited two young daughters, and the celebration with our family and friends. I moved on, scratched another 60. We had a party at our house when I turned 60. My sisters and their husbands, kids, grandkids, neighbors all came. We had a big food spread and we danced and danced. 7. I flashed the vision of myself, a pious little girl wearing my older sister's hand-me-down white nylon dress and veil with a plastic pearl tiara, about to receive my first communion. My mother was recovering from surgery for the cancer that would take her from us within a few years, watched from the car as I walked, one child among 100, in a sea of white. What would I have told that little girl? 55. I was a winner at 55, at the peak of a career I loved, inspired by the many staff new to America who created a safe haven for people in the last stages of their lives and bringing comfort to their families. I served, always knowing it was a responsibility and a privilege. 29. My age when my first child was born. 34. A single parent of 2 with a full-time job. I was 34 when I finished my college degree. Scratching and having fun and remembering where I was in life at that age. 44. Got a life-changing promotion at work. 15. Skinny teenager taunting the nuns, grieving my mother. 12. First kiss playing spin the bottle in Jimmy Power's garage. None of the numbers I scratched matched any of the winning numbers on the lottery ticket. But the game was no longer about a prize. I was marking milestones, passages in a life of fortunes. At 67 and widowed, steeped in grief, I thought I'd never escape. But I met a wonderful man, a widower. I brought happiness to his life, too, at 67. I was scratching and remembering all of these successes, not my missteps or regrets, mistakes, missed opportunities, and the words I can't take back. 32, my second daughter was born. 62, I visited Ireland for the first time. 57, the birth of my first grandson. I remembered my 30s and 40s. The kids playing at the beach, dance recitals, bikes mounted on the back of the car, Christmas trees, hollowed out pumpkins on the porch, proms and graduations. I thought about how loved I have been and how much I've loved the good people who guided me when I was lost, helped me grow, and believed in me. I smiled thinking about the many that I've mentored and those who mentored me. The gifts of wisdom, patience, and forgiveness that have been bestowed on me. The gratitude I have for a career in service to the poor in spirit. It was a simple scratch ticket stuck in my Christmas stocking, a reflection of decades of blessings. Isn't that beautiful? Beautiful story. Something that's easily doable for others too, isn't it? A lot of it just has to do with where is our brain? Where is our mindset? You have heard me say often, how can we make things into an opportunity? And I think each one of these stories, in some way or another, brings that point up. And also, our long-lost memories, shall I say, the ones that we are not consciously aware of, many call them a cellular memory, connection might we have with our ancient ancestors. There's all kinds of things that when you start realizing that we, in many ways, are surrounded by many memories. And that's why some people do like to remind us to be careful at times of when we bring things into our homes that they may have contrary vibrations with them. This quote by Paulo Coelho is very succinct. And he says, visit your soul, not your past. It's something to think about, isn't it? This next quote by Shannon L. Alder. There comes a time in your life when you have to choose to turn the page, write another book, or simply close it. Jess Rothenberg is quoted as saying, sometimes remembering hurts too much. And I will say, walking through our pains oftentimes does come through our memories. Whether they're accurate or not, it's what we were feeling at the time if we do have painful memories. Wow. Thank you so much for joining me today, and we'll get back again next week. Bye for now.
Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
Did you ever feel that things were not quite right? That everything was just ever so slightly askew?
Do you have, to paraphrase Morpheus, a splinter in your mind?
If you're interested in hearing the latest information about UFOs, the paranormal,
ancient cultures and structures,
monatomic elements,
longevity,
fantastic discoveries in science,
download it to your brain,
then tune in to us. Hi, I'm Dave.
And I'm Mackie.
And we are Shiny Side Out, Sundays 2 to 4 a.m. Eastern. See you then.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
The Secret Kindergarten is here for the young children of the world. The best program on the radio for kids. Dealing with the most important topics in the whole universe. Fairy tales, music and movement, numbers, plants, animals, fun, colors, insects. Take care and cast your ears out to catch a story from the world of other young things. Reach out, up, under, and over. Sing a song. Talk about feelings.